body. Behind the other two, an item of far less interest. Say, the complete works of Shakespeare in Serbian. You have chosen door number one. The sample space in this case is the list of three possible outcomes. Maserati behind door number one, Maserati behind door number two, and Maserati behind door number three. Each one of these has a probability of 1 in 3. Since the assumption is that most people would prefer the Maserati, the first case is the winning case, and your chances of having guessed right are 1 in 3. Now, according to the problem, the next thing that happens is that the host, who knows what's behind all the doors, opens one you did not choose, revealing one of the sets of Shakespeare. In opening this door, the host has used what he knows to avoid revealing the Maserati, so this is not a completely random process. There are two cases to consider. One is the case in which your initial choice was correct. Let's call that the lucky guess scenario. The host will now randomly open door number two or door number three. And if you choose to switch, instead of enjoying a fast, sexy ride, you'll be the owner of Troilus and Cressida in the Torlakian dialect. In the lucky guess scenario, you are better off not switching. But the probability of landing in the lucky guess scenario is only 1 in 3. The other case we must consider is that in which your initial choice was wrong. We'll call that the wrong guess scenario. The chances you guessed wrong are 2 out of 3. So the wrong guess scenario is twice as likely to occur as the lucky guess scenario. How does the wrong guess scenario differ from the lucky guess scenario? In the wrong guess scenario, the Maserati is behind one of the doors you did not choose, and a copy of the Serbian Shakespeare is behind the other unchosen door. Unlike the lucky guess scenario, in this scenario, the host does not randomly open an unchosen door. Since he does not want to reveal the Maserati, he chooses to open precisely the door that does not have the Maserati behind it. In other words, in the wrong guess scenario, the host intervenes in what until now has been a random process. So the process is no longer random. The host uses his knowledge to bias the result, violating randomness by guaranteeing that if you switch your choice, you will get the fancy red car. Because of this intervention, you will find yourself in the wrong guess scenario. You will win if you switch, and lose if you don't. To summarize, if you are in the lucky guess scenario, probability 1 in 3, you'll win if you stick with your choice. If you are in the wrong guess scenario, probability 2 in 3, owing to the actions of the host, you will win if you switch your choice. And so your decision comes down to a guess. In which scenario do you find yourself? If you feel that ESP or fate has guided your initial choice, maybe you shouldn't switch. But unless you can bend silver spoons into pretzels with your brainwaves, the odds are 2 to 1 that you are in the wrong guess scenario. And so it is better to switch. Statistics from the television program bear this out. Those who found themselves in the situation described in the problem and switched their choice won about twice as often as those who did not. The Monty Hall problem is hard to grasp because unless you think about it carefully, the role of the host, like that of your mother, goes unappreciated. But the host is fixing the game. The host's role can be made obvious if we suppose that instead of 3 doors, there were 100. You still choose door number 1, but now you have a probability of 1 in 100 of being right. Meanwhile, the chance of the Maseratis being behind one of the other doors is 99 in 100. As before, the host opens all but one of the doors that you did not pick, being sure not to open the door hiding the Maserati if it is one of them. After he has done, the chances are still 1 in 100 that the Maserati was behind the door you chose, and still 99 in 100 that it was behind one of the other doors. But now, thanks to the intervention of the host, There is only one door left, representing all 99 of those other doors. And so, the probability that the Maserati is behind the remaining door is 99 out of 100. Had the Monty Hall problem been around in Cardano's day, would he have been a Marilyn Vos Savant or Paul Erdos? The law of sample space handles the problem nicely, but we have no way of knowing for sure, for the earliest known statement of the problem under a different name didn't occur until 1959, in an article by Martin Gardner in Scientific American. Gardner called it a wonderfully confusing little problem, and noted that in no other branch of mathematics is it so easy for experts to blunder as in probability theory. Of course, to a mathematician, a blunder is an issue of embarrassment, but to a gambler, it is an issue of livelihood. And so, it is fitting that when it came to the first systematic theory of probability, it took Cardano, the gambler, to figure things out. One day, while Cardano was in his teens, one of his friends died suddenly. After a few months, Cardano noticed, his friend's name was no longer mentioned by anyone. This saddened him and left a deep impression. How does one overcome the fact that life is transitory? He decided that the only way was to leave something behind. Heirs, or lasting works of some kind, or both. In his autobiography, Cardano describes developing an unshakable ambition to leave his mark on the world. After obtaining his medical degree, Cardano returned to Milan, seeking employment. While in college, he had written a paper on the differing opinions of physicians that essentially called the medical establishment a bunch of quacks. The Milan College of Physicians now returned the favor, refusing to admit him. That meant he could not practice in Milan, and so, using money he had saved from his tutoring and gambling, Cardano bought a tiny house to the east, in the town of Povis di Sacco. He expected to do good business there because disease was rife in the town, and it had no physician. But his market research had a fatal flaw. The town had no doctor because the populace preferred to be treated by sorcerers and priests. After years of intense work and study, Cardano found himself with little income, but a lot of spare time on his hands. It proved a lucky break, for he seized the opportunity and began to write books. One of them was The Book on Games of Chance. In 1532, after 5 years in Sacco, Cardano moved back to Milan, hoping to have his work published and once again applying for membership in the College of Physicians. On both fronts, he was roundly rejected. "In those days," he wrote, "I was sickened so to the heart that I would visit diviners and wizards so that some solution might be found to my manifold troubles." One wizard suggested he shield himself from moon rays. Another that, on waking, he sneeze 3 times and knock on wood. Cardano followed all their prescriptions, but none changed his bad fortune. And so, hooded, he took to sneaking from building to building at night, surreptitiously treating patients who either couldn't afford the fees of sanctioned doctors or else didn't improve in their care. To supplement the income he earned from that endeavor, he wrote in his autobiography, "He was forced to the dice again, so that I could support my wife, and here my knowledge defeated fortune, and we were able to buy food and live, though our lodgings were desolate." As for the book on games of chance, though he would revise and improve the manuscript repeatedly in the years to come, he never again sought to have it published, perhaps because he realized it wasn't a good idea to teach anyone to gamble as well as he could. Cardano eventually achieved his goals in life, obtaining both heirs and fame, and a good deal of fortune to boot. The fortune began to accrue when he published a book based on his old college paper, altering the title from the somewhat academic On the Differing Opinions of Physicians to the zinger On the Bad Practice of Medicine in Common Use. The book was a hit. And then, when one of his secret patients, a well-known prior of the Augustinian Order of Friars, suddenly, and in all likelihood by chance, improved and attributed his recovery to Cardano's care, Cardano's fame as a physician took off on an upward spiral that reached such heights, the College of Physicians felt compelled not only to grant him membership, but also to make him its rector. Meanwhile, he was publishing more books, and they did well, especially one for the general public called The Practice of Arithmetic. A few years later, he published a more technical book called The Great Art, a treatise on algebra in which he gave the first clear picture of negative numbers and a famous analysis of certain algebraic equations. When he reached his early 50s, in the mid-1550s, Cardano was at his peak, chairman of medicine at the University of Pavia, and a wealthy man. His good fortune didn't last. To a large extent, what brought Cardano down was the other part of his legacy, his children. When she was 16, his daughter, Chiara, named after his mother, seduced his older son, Giovanni, and became pregnant. She had a successful abortion, but it left her infertile. That suited her just fine, for she was boldly promiscuous, even after her marriage, and contracted syphilis. Giovanni went on to become a doctor, but was soon more famous as a petty criminal. So famous, he was blackmailed into marriage by a family of gold diggers who had proof that he had murdered, by poison, a minor city official. Meanwhile, Aldo, Cardano's younger son, who as a child had engaged in the torture of animals, turned that passion into work as a freelance torturer for the Inquisition. And like Giovanni, he moonlighted as a crook. A few years after his marriage, Giovanni gave one of his servants a mysterious mixture to incorporate into a cake for Giovanni's wife. When she keeled over after enjoying her dessert, the authorities put two and two together. Despite Girolamo spending a fortune on lawyers, his attempts to pull strings, and his testimony on his son's behalf, young Giovanni was executed in prison a short while later. The drain on Cardano's funds and reputation made him vulnerable to his old enemies. The Senate in Milan expunged his name from the list of those allowed to lecture, and, accusing him of sodomy and incest, had him exiled from the province. When Cardano left Milan at the end of 1563, he wrote in his autobiography, "He was reduced once more to rags. My fortune gone, my income ceased, my rents withheld, my books impounded." By that time, his mind was going too, and he was given to periods of incoherence. As a final blow, a self-taught mathematician named Niccolo Tartaglia, angry because in his book, The Great Art, Cardano had revealed Tartaglia's secret method of solving certain equations, coaxed Aldo into giving evidence against his father in exchange for an official appointment as public torturer and executioner for the city of Bologna. Cardano was jailed briefly, then quietly lived out his last few years in Rome. The book on games of chance was finally published in 1663, over 100 years after young Cardano had first put the words to paper. By then, his methods of analysis had been reproduced and surpassed. Chapter 4. Tracking the Pathways to Success. If a gambler of Cardano's day had understood Cardano's mathematical work on chance, he could have made a tidy profit betting against less sophisticated players. Today, with what he had to offer, Cardano could have achieved both fame and fortune writing books like The Idiot's Guide to Casting Dice with Suckers. But in his own time, Cardano's work made no big splash, and his Book on Games of Chance remained unpublished until long after his death. Why did Cardano's work have so little impact? As we've said, one hindrance to those who preceded him was the lack of a good system of algebraic notation. That system in Cardano's day was improving, but was still in its infancy. Another roadblock, however, had yet to be removed. Cardano worked at a time when mystical incantation was more valued than mathematical calculation. If people did not look for the order in nature, and did not develop numerical descriptions of events, then a theory of the effect of randomness on those events was bound to go unappreciated. As it turned out, had Cardano lived just a few decades later, both his work and its reception might have been far different. For the decades after his death saw the unfolding of historic changes in European thought and belief, a transformation that has traditionally been dubbed the Scientific Revolution. The Scientific Revolution was a revolt against a way of thinking that was prevalent as Europe emerged from the Middle Ages, an era in which people's beliefs about the way the world worked were not scrutinized in any systematic manner. Merchants in one town stole the clothes of a hanged man because they believed it would help their sales of beer. Parishioners in another believed illness could be cured by chanting sacrilegious prayers as they marched naked around their church altar. One trader even believed that relieving himself in the wrong toilet would bring bad fortune. Actually, he was a bond trader who confessed his secret to a CNN reporter in 2003. Yes, some people still adhere to superstitions today, but at least today, for those who are interested, we have the intellectual tools to prove or disprove the efficacy of such actions. But if Cardano's contemporaries, say, won at dice, rather than analyzing their experience mathematically, they would say a prayer of thanks or refuse to wash their lucky socks. Cardano himself believed that streaks of losses occur because fortune is averse, and that one way to improve your results is to give the dice a good hard throw. If a lucky seven is all in the wrist, why stoop to mathematics? The moment that is often considered the turning point for the Scientific Revolution came in 1583, just 7 years after Cardano's death. That is when a young student at the University of Pisa sat in a cathedral and, according to legend, rather than listening to the services, stared at something he found far more intriguing: the swinging of a large, hanging lamp. Using his pulse as a timer, Galileo Galilei noticed that the lamp seemed to take the same amount of time to swing through a wide arc as it did to swing through a narrow one. That observation suggested to him a law. The time required by a pendulum to perform a swing is independent of the amplitude of the swing. Galileo's was a precise and practical observation, and although simple, it signified a new approach to the description of physical phenomena. The idea that science must focus on experience and experimentation, how nature operates, rather than on what intuition dictates or our minds find appealing. And most of all, it must be done with mathematics. Galileo employed his scientific skills to write a short piece on gambling, Thoughts About Dice Games. The work was produced at the behest of his patron, the Grand Duke of Tuscany. The problem that bothered the Grand Duke was this: when you throw three dice, why does the number 10 appear more frequently than the number 9? The excess of tens is only about 8%, and neither 10 nor 9 comes up very often. So the fact that the Grand Duke played enough to notice the small difference means he probably needed a good 12-step program more than he needed Galileo. For whatever reason, Galileo was not keen to work on the problem and grumbled about it. But like any consultant who wants to stay employed, he kept his grumbling low-key and did his job. If you throw a single die, the chances of any number in particular coming up are 1 in 6. But if you throw two dice, the chances of different totals are no longer equal. For example, there is a 1 in 36 chance of the dice totaling 2, but twice that chance of their totaling 3. The reason is that a total of 2 can be obtained only by one way, by tossing 2 ones. But a total of 3 can be obtained in 2 ways, by tossing a 1 and then a 2, or a 2 and then a 1. That brings us to the next big step in understanding random processes, which is the subject of this chapter: the development of systematic methods for analyzing the number of ways in which events can happen. The key to understanding the Grand Duke's confusion is to approach the problem as if you were a Talmudic scholar. Rather than attempting to explain why 10 comes up more frequently than 9, we ask, why shouldn't 10 come up more frequently than 9? It turns out there is a 10